And welcome to Conversations with the Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Dorinda Sharp.
And I'm Colin Hesse. On this episode, Dorinda talks with Stacy Lantain, assistant professor at the University of Mississippi School of Law. She was on campus as part of the Law School Speaker Exchange to discuss her research on fan fiction and the law.
We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You're here as part of our speaker exchange series, so today you'll be speaking to some of the law faculty. Just thought you might want to talk a little bit about what you're going to present.
Sure. Today I'm presenting a piece on RPF, which is a fan phenomenon called Real Person Fic, which is about aggressively fictional online stories about celebrities. So, for instance, one of the more famous ones is a story about the One Direction band members being college students. So there's all sorts of stories like that. Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook fights zombies, things like that. And what I decided to do, I've been writing a lot of articles on fan communities, and no one was really talking about this particular fan activity. And I think it's really interesting because it's not the same as the usual type of fan fiction that's about a fictional creation. So normally fan fiction is like Pride and Prejudice and zombies. It's, you know, you take Elizabeth Bennet and Fitzwilliam Darcy and you stick them into a zombie world. But what I'm talking about here is more like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Mm-hmm. The thought being that these are real people. They're not fictional creations. So copyright doesn't really have a place there. And a lot of the analyses that have been done of fan activities really focus on copyright issues. So I decided to look at these pieces of real person fiction and try to figure out if they're legal, because there's a lot of debate online about real person fic, not debate by lawyers, debate by fans, and whether or not you should be doing this and how squicky it is and all that kind of stuff. And when they have these debates, they either say things that are just legally wrong, or they say, I don't care, I just don't like it. And I thought it would be really interesting to actually sit and figure out what their legality is. And what's really interesting about my piece, I ended up having to look at copyright law and trademark law and privacy rights and publicity rights. It's a whole bunch of different areas of law intersecting. And what was interesting was I started it thinking that these things were going to be a violation of publicity rights, and that was what I thought I was going to come to the conclusion. And then the more research I did, the more I decided that, no, they're actually totally legally permissible. And in fact, I think they're more legally permissible than all of, like, the Oscar-nominated movies about real people that we have. So it was a fun and interesting journey to go through. I'm not sure I've ever had my mind change so many times in the course of working on a paper. So that will be the presentation I'm going to make and the journey I'm going to take the faculty through, hopefully.
Is that partially because the people who are being written about are public figures?
Yes. So publicity rights only apply to celebrities. Of course, that is a difficult definition, it turns out, in the modern era of viral YouTube videos and reality television shows. But yeah, to the extent that you are a public figure, you basically are exposed to more people being able to tell stories about you because of the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is there's scholarship out there that says that celebrities are basically our gods and goddesses, that we don't have story, we don't have myths anymore about Zeus, but we tell stories about celebrities, and that's how we have our cultural connection with each other. So once you look at it from that perspective, it actually starts, you start to realize it's actually really important for people to be able to tell stories about celebrities. This is apparently how we communicate with each other. And if you look at the Oscar nomination lists, it's always, there's always a bunch of movies based on true stories, like they're telling us about celebrities. So my theory was that there was importance behind this. Like, once I started to see it that way, and actually the harm that someone's going to read a crazy story about Taylor Swift fighting zombies and think Taylor Swift really is fighting zombies, that's minute, much less than the harm that you might read a story in a tabloid that's not true about Taylor Swift and think that that's true.
And who she may or may not be dating at any moment.
Right, exactly. So once I realized that, I said, you know, actually, if I were a celebrity, I'd be more upset about tabloids than I'd be upset about this crazy story about me on Mars, you know. So that's the conclusion I reached.
That's really interesting. Do you see this going other places, or have you hit kind of the end of this one and moving on to something else?
What's interesting is my colleagues think I could get 3 or 4 more articles out of this. There's so every time I turned a corner on my research, I was like, and now there's this other really interesting thing. So one of the things I'm really thinking about is my previous work was about making sure, like, listening to what fans think about the law, and that's actually instructive to us. And in this piece, I'm like, they have the law all wrong. Like, the fans don't understand that this is totally okay, and in fact, it's something we should be doing. And I would really like to do a piece that's actually looking at, okay, when do I think that the fans get it right and we should listen to them, and when do I not think that, and what's my sort of overarching, why am I willing to dismiss them here, but I'm okay with it there? So that, I think, is going to be the next thing I really turn to and figure out a guide for when we should let fans guide us as to what the law should be.
How did you get into copyright and trademark law? Is that something you'd always been interested in, or is there an interesting path that led you there?
it wasn't really something that I was always interested in, to the extent that when I went to law school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I wasn't one of those people who went in with, oh, I really love copyright and trademark stuff. I happened to take a copyright course while I was in law school, mostly because the professor came highly recommended and it fit my schedule. And I was like, sure, I'll do it. And he said something that really stuck with me, which was that he went into copyright because he loved books. And I had been an English major. I also write novels on the side for fun. And I love books. And I thought that really stuck with me. And then when I got out of law school, I clerked for a year. And I clerked in New Orleans, so I had a lot of really interesting copyright and trademark cases with New Orleans artists, with bars trying to trademark the name of cocktails. I mean, really fascinating things that when you have that as your experience, of course that's what you want to go into. I was like, I want to work with trademarking cocktails the rest of my life. So that was what drew me into trademarking copyright, and I started practicing. And I think it ended up being really perfect, like exactly what I thought it was going to be. It's legal, but you do get to make a lot more English majory arguments about, you know, the tone of the work and the feel of it, and what are you actually trying to say, and what's the commentary and the impact of words on people. It just really appealed to that more English major side of my brain, which I enjoyed.
That's fantastic. So what led you from practicing into teaching?
That is also a complicated, convoluted path. I literally happened to go to like a seminar that was being taught by professors, not about my specialty. It was about management and managing people and stuff. But it was fantastic. I had just a great time really thinking about all of these issues. I hadn't been in the classroom in, you know, 10 years at that point. And I thought, I actually really miss this. Like, I miss just sitting around and thinking about the law. And even though I thought about the law every day on a daily basis, it wasn't the same sort of, I can really sit and engage, like, what do I think about fans and fan fiction? And, like, I'm never going to have a case about that. So there was a definite thought that maybe I wanted to transition from practice and go into something like that. And I also felt that I'd actually learned a lot in practice. And I learned a lot on the ground. Like, I didn't know what to expect going in. And I felt like I could bring that to school and be like, look, this is the stuff that I've learned. I don't want you to start and not know these things the way I didn't know them. Like, I'll tell you flat out, like, you're gonna have to bill your time. This is what a complaint looks like. Like, this is what discovery is like. All these things that I had no idea, I felt I could really share with the students. And so it's been nice. I've enjoyed both the teaching and the scholarship side of things.
That's great. So your practice side, your professional side, obviously informed your academic side.
Yeah.
How did that all come together?
Actually, my first couple of articles were very linked to issues that I'd had come up in practice that I thought, this makes no sense. And so then I wrote an article about how this doesn't make sense. So at first I was really thinking about, like, I did a piece on deceptive advertising class actions, like nothing that had to do with fan activities. And then what ended up really, I was a fan. I am a fan. I had, like, been exposed to fan fiction, and I had a friend who knew that I did copyright and was kind of like, hey, what's the legality of that? And I was like, that is such a good question. I don't know. And that actually helped me transition more. Like, once I started to dig in and think about that more closely, I realized there's so much stuff going on the internet, so much stuff that nobody has stopped to consider. And so that makes it really fun because practice was my way into it, and I learned all of the law through that. But literally, I just sit around on the internet, and this is my scholarship. This is I like look at internet memes, and I'm like, that's really interesting. What's the copyright implication of that meme? You know, and it's great. I like that because I feel that it's really bringing the law into our daily lives in a way that when I was practicing, my friends and family were just like, I don't know what you're talking about. And now I can say, no, it's like that thing on Twitter, like, and they're like, oh, yeah. And it's really nice.
I run into a lot of undergrads. Mm-hmm. Our undergraduate population has, you know, so many things they can study here. And there are many who are interested in going to law school but aren't quite sure. And they want to prepare however they can to get in and to be successful once they get in. Do you have any advice?
I do, because I was like those undergrads. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And so I went to law school without kind of thinking of how to prepare. So I'm glad that they are thinking of how to prepare. So like I said, I was an English major. I think that really helped because I was used to reading a lot, and you do a lot of reading for homework. So I was used to having to do that. Of course, it's a totally different type of reading, so I'm not sure what you could do in undergrad that would prepare you for reading cases, unless you want to sit around reading cases for fun, and I don't recommend you do that in undergrad. But getting used to doing a lot of reading, doing a lot of writing is really important, not just because you'll do writing in law school, but being a lawyer is actually a lot of writing, and so it's helpful to not be intimidated by that and to be used to how your writing process goes. The other thing that I would recommend, though, when I decided that I was going to go to law school, you have to take the LSAT, that's the entrance exam. And someone told me to take a logic class and that would help prepare me for the LSAT. And I had room on my schedule, and I was like, okay, we've now learned that this is how I scheduled all of college and law school, was just, there's room in my schedule. I was like, okay. But I do think that was really helpful for the LSAT, was the logic class, because it turned out that the LSAT was a lot of logic puzzles. And so the fact that I had taken logic, I think, helped. So I would recommend that. I also took, I don't know if the undergrad offers this, but I took like a little business law class through the business school that I was allowed to take. And that was nice. Like, it wasn't exactly like law school, but it was sort of, it gave me more confidence. And by then I'd already applied to law school and accepted, but it gave me a little more confidence, like, okay, I can do this. I think it's going to be interesting. So any classes that brush up against the law like that, even really interesting things like gender theory and race theory and stuff like that, all of that stuff, it really has to do with the law. Like, our laws are helping to establish that hierarchy in society, and that can be really an interesting way to go at law.
That's great. So you said you hadn't intended to go to law school. What led you there?
I didn't. So when I went to college, I was an English major, which I did because I wanted to read the great books, and I thought I wouldn't unless people made me. So that was my reasoning behind that. And then I was like, what am I going to do, though, with an English major? I wasn't really interested in journalism. Like, all of the Englishy types of things just didn't interest me. I also was a computer science minor, and I thought maybe I will go into computer science. And I enjoyed my minor, but mostly what it taught me was, like, I couldn't spend 8 hours a day doing computer programming. That just wasn't my thing. So law school kind of becomes your default in that situation. And that's not a good reason to go to law school, so I wouldn't encourage that. But once I sort of thought, like, what am I going to do? I guess I better go to law school. That was when I started to, like, I took the logic class, I took the business law class, and I think that that helped to make me realize, like, oh, yeah, I'll be really, this will work for me. What's good about law school, though, is that honestly, no matter what you're interested in, you will find a part of law school that will speak to that. So like I liked Englishy stuff, so I ended up in copyright and trademark, and I was litigating and I was arguing. But I had friends who were more into math and that kind of stuff, and they do securities regulation and they're putting together tax code things. I don't understand what they do. But we're both doing law, and so you can find your niche in law school, and that's actually really nice and not something that I thought about before I went to law school. I thought we'd all just be doing the same thing, but there's lots of really different ways to practice law.
That makes sense. It seems like it's worked out well.
It has. So I look back and I think, what would I change? And it's not going to law school, so that's good.
That is good. And Stacey, we would like to talk a little bit about, since there's so much fan fiction out there, what's the legal line between fan fiction that makes money and that doesn't, that maybe has a billion views, but that doesn't translate into any kind of revenue?
Right. The problem with this question, and the reason why I've been able to make a career out of this, is that there really is no legal line. It's all very fuzzy. I think a lot of fans think as long as they don't make money, they're protected from a copyright infringement attack. And as a matter of law, that's actually not true. Copyright law doesn't really care whether or not you're making money. This is why music downloading was a copyright infringement. You weren't making any money off of sharing your music with the rest of the world,
right,
but you were harming the market of the original, and so that's where the harm comes in. If fan fiction is considered to harm the market of the original, then it's copyright infringing, whether you're making money or not. I think the reason that a lot of fans think they're okay if they don't make money is because many copyright holders only go after the people who are making money. They don't seem to care, or at least not want to spend money on their lawyers until there's actually money at stake. So this is why some authors take a stand, and J.K. Rowling's okay with fan fiction. I don't think she likes mature fan fiction, but she's okay with other forms of fan fiction. But she did take to court a guy who was going to sell a Harry Potter encyclopedia, because to her that was crossing the line. And the same thing just recently happened within the last month or so. A group of Star Trek fans had gotten together and had a Kickstarter where they raised a bunch of funds for a Star Trek movie that they're going to make, basically. And Paramount just sued them. And, I mean, there's millions of other types of Star Trek fan activities out there, but it's the ones that start making money that tend to attract attention. That said, just making money off of it doesn't mean you're copyright infringing. On the other flip side of things, I think there's a lot of stuff that you could do and you could make money and you wouldn't be copyright infringing, and we protect a lot of that stuff. So commentary and criticism and parodies and all that kind of thing, those are totally okay. You can write those and you can make money off of them, and we would protect that and not consider that copyright infringing. So this is why it's so complicated, because it's very fuzzy. And there are a lot of, not a lot, but a fair number of authors who actually just hate fan fiction in general and come out against it in very strong terms. And they're not right either, you know? So nobody's actually, there is no absolute answer. There's no black or white, yes or no, on fan fiction. And I think if anybody tries to give you one of those, then you it's your red flag that they're not really taking into account the full implications of what the legal precedent is out there. But it is really interesting. And part of that is one of the things that I've looked at in my scholarship is that having an active fandom actually increases the value of the original copyrighted work, because fans will spend money on whatever you put in front of them, which might explain why a lot of copyright holders let fan fiction and fan art and fan vids and all of that stuff go on, because actually those are the people who are going to go crazy and buy every piece of merchandise that you put out there. So the money and fan fiction thing is actually a really complex situation.
Are there ever cases where someone's writing fan fiction and it starts to get some traction, and that author gets the blessing of the original author to, yes, go with this?
That's a good question. I know that, so 50 Shades of Grey, for instance, infamously started out life as a fan fiction of Twilight. When it was published, they changed the names and they took out vampire references and all that kind of stuff. And I know that, like, Stephanie Meyer didn't sue, and she was kind of like, more power to you, right? Like, you want to make money off of that? That's fine. I'm trying to think off the top of my head of an instance where a writer saw someone writing fan fiction in their universe and was like, that's awesome. There are actually people making YouTube series where they are encouraging people to go out and write fan fiction, and then they go through the fan fiction and they pick the ones that they like the best, and that gets put into the next fan fiction. And I wish I could remember the name of it. It's something like After the Rain or Through the Rain or something, but people could Google that, and that's a really interesting thing people are doing.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Is there any other direction you see things going?
It's complicated. I like that fan fiction is mostly done for free. It's done out of love, and I think that's kind of nice. But I also think that mainstream society will continue to dismiss it as an art form until they start demanding money. So to be honest, I'm completely torn about what direction I think. I really like the way it is, and I hope it stays that way. But I do see the arguments that, you know, when people make fan fiction for money, we call it like a really cool movie, right? Or something. And fan fiction that's written in your bedroom gets dismissed, and I'm not sure that that's fair.
In addition to her legal practice and her legal teaching, she's also a novelist.
I am.
Would you tell us, please, about your novels?
I write young adult novels. I've written a couple of young adult fantasy novels, The Girl Who Never Was and The Boy with the Hidden Name, they're called. And they have some associated novellas that are actually free. So you could go online and you could download them now. It's just, I'd always wanted to do, I've always been a writer. I've written stories since I was six. And I was like, let me give it a try. And it all worked out. It's been great.
And how long have you been doing that?
That's a good question. Let me think about what year it is right now. The books got published about a year ago, a couple of years ago now. All of the years are blending together. Yeah. But I wrote them around 5 years ago. And that's how long, it literally takes that long to, you finish your first draft and then you get it sold and then you edit it. It just takes a long time. It's a painstaking process, which surprised me. Once I sold the books, I told everyone I knew. And then it was like 3 years later, like they came out. So the novelty had kind of worn off by that point. So that's how long I've been a novelist. But what's interesting is I tell people this all the time, that I'd written since I was a child. So the funny thing is, although I'm now a published novelist, I realized I was a writer all along. Like, as long as you're writing words on paper, you can call yourself a writer. There's no magic about having the book. It's just nice because now they sit on my bookshelf, you know. So
do you do things like go on book tour?
I generally, when I go and visit a place, I will try to add a signing in. I didn't do that here, but generally that's what I do. So I'm not really going on tour, so much as my publishing house will just be like, oh yeah, we'll help you add that signing on there. So it's nothing that's as regulated as an actual tour, but I've seen, like, I went to Seattle actually to do a book signing out there, and I'm originally from the Northeast, so in the summertime I did a whole tour of like bookstores on Cape Cod and New Hampshire and Maine, and that was very fun, and bookstores in the South, and yeah, it's been great. It's really fun to do the events and meet the people, and yeah.
Does your legal background feed into the novels at all?
Not at all, which my friends find hysterical. They read them and they're like, you would never know you're a lawyer. And I'm like, good. Like, I don't want them to be. So I have friends who write legal thrillers. And so their legal practice is clearly informing that. I feel like all day I sit and I write law-based stuff. I don't want to go home and for fun write about the law. Like, I want to go home and for fun I write about like goblins, you know, like that's what I want to do. So the only thing is that at one point something happens and one of the characters who's a wizard is like, well, we can't do anything about that. That's not our jurisdiction. The goblins have to handle it. And my friend was like, only a lawyer would put the word jurisdiction into their young adult fantasy novel. And I was like, I guess that's true. So in that respect, I guess it spills out. But no, they have nothing to do with the law, and that's the best. For me, that's the best part about it. I wanted it to be fun. I don't want it to feel like work. And even when I decided to try to get them published, I was like, I'm really worried that it will start to feel like work. And writing had always been an escape and a release for me. And so I've been really careful to keep it separate. So it's fun.
That's fantastic. So you're talking about being in New Orleans and all the things you saw with copyright law.
Yes.
And of course, knowing your background in English, I immediately go to John Grisham.
Yeah. who is an Ole Miss grad.
Yes.
So,
and an Arkansas native.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, there you go. I read John Grisham novels growing up. He probably doesn't want me to say growing up. I read them when I was younger, and I love John Grisham novels. And if John Grisham is listening and would like to hang out, that would be super cool. That would be excellent.
Sure.
I would love his career. Although it was fascinating, I just didn't want to do the legal thriller thing. Every once in a while, I get like a law-based idea. It's funny because in class when I'm lecturing, I'll give like a hypo and then I'm like, you guys, that's such a great idea for a book. And they all like stare at me and then I go back up to my office and I like write myself a quick little like email, like good story idea. So my latest one was about art forgery and how if what you're doing, if the forgery is so fantastic that nobody can tell the difference, why, like, would that actually be copyright infringement, or could you hire a lawyer who could get you around it like in a fair use way? And so I haven't given a lot of thought to that, but I'm literally teaching a seminar on fair use and gave that as a hypo. And then I was like, what a cool story that would make to have like an art forger hire a lawyer to try to get him off the charges based on copyright law. And of course, my students just like stared at me. But but I think it's going to make a great story someday.
Well, that's great. We will look for it on the shelves along with your other books.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Music for Conversations with the Academy was written and performed by Josh Woodward. For more information and additional podcasts, go to kuaf.com or law.uark.edu. You can also listen to episodes or subscribe to our podcast through iTunes, on Stitcher, or with your favorite podcast app. Follow the University of Arkansas School of Law on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for UARK Law. That's UARKLAW. Thank you for listening.